Good afternoon. You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF 90.9 in Paonia and KVMT 89.1 in Montrose and on the web at kvnf.org. I'm Allie Lightfoot, and Local Motion is KVNF's weekly program that focuses on local arts, public affairs, and news. We highlight people, ideas, and projects in our area that are innovative and moving us forward. Today on the show, I'm here with IC Change producer Julia Kumari-Drabkin, and we'll be hearing from some old-timers today on the topic of change. Who's witnessed more change than the old-timers? Julia went out and spoke with several locals who have been in the area for at least 50 years to find out what they've seen change over the years. Stay tuned.
KVNF's news department has been keeping you informed of major stories all year long.
The Waldo Canyon fire broke through containment lines yesterday and drove into Colorado Springs.
The commissioners scheduled a special meeting Thursday morning to determine if Edwin Hostetler had met the conditions required for approval of the henhouse operation.
Proponents and opponents of a proposed uranium mill near Naderita will have a court-ordered hearing on the mill in November.
Yesterday, the Bureau of Land Management approved Oxbow Mining's plans to explore for coal on Oak Mesa, north
County
of
County Environmental Health Director Ken Nordstrom said the rise in West Nile cases is due to this year's exceptionally warm spring.
KVNF News covers the issues that matter to communities across the Western Slope. During our fall pledge drive, we're asking that you give to help maintain and strengthen the valuable, accurate news we provide to you every weekday. Support your local public radio news here on KVNF.
Wow. That's right. What a year it's been. And we're here with IC Change. It's an IC Change special live here in the KVNF studios. We'll be hearing from some local old timers over in the next hour on the topic of change. We're looking for your calls as well. Whether you're an old timer or a newcomer, we'd love to hear from you about the changes that you've seen. I know one of the questions we want to ask you, the listening public, is what qualifies someone as an old-timer anyway? Is there a debate about this, Julia?
Well, it's funny that you say that, Allie. In many ways, there's always been a debate. That's something I learned after spending an afternoon with June and Dallas Harding at their ranch on Minnesota Creek Road. So I would like to go ahead and play clips. We're going to be playing clips kind of like a DJ plays music. And I'm going to be calling out to our extraordinary engineer, Jeff Reynolds. So Jeff, if you would play the old timers clip.
And so you guys are pretty much the old timers of the old timers, as I understand it.
We really are.
But she's she thinks she's just a newcomer because she's only been around for 61 years.
I am new here. I am not considered one of the older, and I'm 81 years old. He's 83.
So that was, again, Dallas and June Harding. Now, Dallas's father homesteaded here from Nebraska in 1902, but June's family moved here when she was in high school, so she's never really felt like a true old-timer. And it doesn't stop there, of course. Dallas remembers that back in the 30s, the newcomers then were the people fleeing the Dust Bowl droughts.
In 1937, there was quite a few people moved in from the Dust Bowl over on the Eastern Slope. And so they started a Minnesota Creek Club, and they called it the Worthwhile Club. And my mother didn't want to head it up, so she got one of the neighbors to volunteer to be president.
So IC Change has been reporting on environmental changes all year, particularly how seasons and climate might be changing, and how those changes might be changing us. So it's been quite a year, and you know, people have said to me, well, you've only spoken to newcomers about change. What about people who've lived here for all their lives, generations back? So we hadn't really spoken to the old timers about change. And Allie, that was actually your suggestion. And so for the last couple of weeks, I've been talking to as many old timers as I can. And I've learned so much about the changes they've seen, not only in this year, but putting this year in perspective, especially the weird weather. We've got lots of great stories to play and lots of insights. But this is a live show, a conversation. We're going to be playing clips as we talk, but it's pretty loose and unscripted. So we definitely want to hear from you, from the listeners. We'd love for you to call us, to join the conversation. We want to hear your perspectives, your observations, and your questions. Newcomers and old-timers alike, all are welcome.
Let me give that number again. The number to call if you'd like to be a part of this conversation is 970-527-4868. And again, we'd like to hear from everybody. You don't have to be an old-timer, although we'd love to hear from the old-timers too.
Well, let's just keep talking to Dallas or hearing from Dallas. He thinks that what has changed is snow, and it's really interesting to hear how he thinks it's changed.
In 1912, it snowed 54 inches in 36 hours here, and I've never ever seen it snow that much. But in 20 years ago, our two of our boys went skiing over at Winter Park. And there was probably a foot of snow on the ground, and it started snowing, and it snowed 30 inches overnight.
In terms of change, you feel like there's less snow?
It's an average. Some years we haven't had any snow like that for 20 years. Last year, it snowed a lot, but it had a lot of moisture in it, but it didn't last. It warmed up and melt, so the north-south slopes was bare most of the winter last year. And the accumulation of snow was pretty deep, but it didn't ever pile up. So normally it snows pretty deep, and then it rains in the spring and kind of sponges it up. But we didn't get those pile-ups on the snow last year.
Now, when it comes to snow and precipitation, there has always been variability. But what's so interesting about what Dallas is talking about is not the quantity of snow, but the quality of snow. He said that even the big snow that happened in 2011 had more moisture in it, and it didn't last as long. So we'll be exploring snow a lot, especially with winter coming. But in a nutshell, if our background temperatures are going up, it makes sense that the behavior of snowpack and snowmelt will also change. And I don't need to remind people here on the Western Slope or in the North Fork community how important snowpack and snowmelt is. This year was a pretty telling example. Locally, ranchers have been hit pretty hard this year because of hay and hay prices. But again, it really does help to talk to old-timers like Dallas and June because you get such interesting perspectives. Dallas remembers the Dust Bowl droughts. And he also says, though, back then they used a different kind of hay.
I remember 1937. Yeah, that was really dry. It was the Dust Bowl. We had some water here. And we took advantage of every drop we could get. But we made our crops and planted alfalfa for hay. And we tried to get the hay put up by the 1st of July. And if we could do that, a lot of times we could get over the hay ground one time with water before the ditches called for decree. Then, and later on in the summer, while we'd get usually had rains, it rained enough that we'd get a second and third cutting even sometimes on that alfalfa.
How does that compare with the way we do hay now?
Well, of course, we use a different kind of hay now than we did then. That was the old Colorado Mountain or common hay, and the stem on it was as big as a pencil, and it wasn't very palatable. It was pretty coarse. It made awful good feed, but the roots would go so much deeper than the Rangers and Grim hay that they put up now has got smaller stems, and it's a lot more palatable, but it doesn't have the root system that the old common alfalfa did have. So that's one reason that there's probably more difference in the plants themselves than there is in the amount of water that they had, because water still runs about the same time. Normally, the high water for Minnesota Creek is Memorial Weekend. And it's, of course, this year we didn't have any high water.
When do we start haying?
About the middle of June.
Hmm.
And
I know he's haying the 4th of July usually, yeah. Our son.
Yeah, we were married on the 6th of July, and we put it off till then so we'd have our hay put up before we got married.
Well, you put off the hay or the marriage?
The marriage. Not the hay, for goodness sake.
That was great.
I love that clip because it is, and I love her actually, it's a perfect example of how the timing of the seasons, particularly water, not only affects crops, it affects us, the rhythms of our daily lives. So Icy Change is documenting not only how weird weather changes the timings of blooms, the timings of birds, but our timings, our economy, our celebrations. Here's a clip from Ruella Contour about trying to figure out a good weather day for a wedding. I met her in Crawford at church.
We were going to get married, and we wanted to get married June the 5th at my aunt and uncle's house up on Pitkin Mesa because they had a beautiful yard with a beautiful view. So we planned it, but we were worried about the weather, whether we'd have rain or not. And the neighbor came up and he said, "Don't worry about it, I've checked it out. Every year since I've been here, I've kept the weather every day, and it has never rained on June 5th. And it still hasn't rained on June 5th around here, as far as we know. Didn't that day, and hasn't any anniversary that we've been here." So.
Wow.
So they've been married and living here for well over 30 years, and I think it's a pretty good bet, though, that there won't be rain in June. June, that's Colorado's driest month in the year, and that's pretty key information for planning, whether it's a wedding, planting crops, managing ditches, or managing pests. And this year has been historic because of the mild winter, the early start of the growing season, and the dry, dry conditions. Pat Polson, who is definitely an old-timer, is one of the hay farmers in Crawford who got hit pretty hard this year.
I've been here a long time, yes. Well, I was born in this area, and I've lived here my whole life. I was born another 5 miles up Highway 92. Do you know where Gould Reservoir was?
I do.
I was a mile above there. It's where I grew up. Yes. the mud now. Well, this is one of the worst years we've had. We've had dry years periodically. The first several years we were married were dry years. I got married in 1954. Mm-hmm. And 54, 55, and 56 were dry. 58 and 59 and 60 were fairly dry again. And then we had a dry year in the 70s and another in the 80s and another in the 90s. So they come pretty frequently, really. But we've never had the wind like we've had it this year. We just have seemed to have all spring had a wind blowing constantly, a dry, warm wind. And it just took what moisture there was. It was really sad.
I'm going to be doing a feature story about Pat's observation, and I'm looking for a scientist to talk about whether or not wind has been changing and what effects it might have had on the dry weather that we've had this year. I'm curious to know if any of our listeners noticed anything weird with wind this year or dry winds. We've heard a lot about that, especially in Crawford. But one thing that Pat and many of the other people here have talked to me about when it comes to change is how their ancestors, those first homesteaders, carved out a living here. And there's a lot of faith in that. You might call it reliance. A scientist might call it adaptation. Pat would definitely call it grit.
My grandfather Cotton, my great-grandfather Cotton, yeah, came in here in 1881. You know, people don't know what people like that went through. He came in with a saddle horse and a pack mule and established a dugout down on the North Fork River and went back to Salida, got his family, brought him here. He married my great-grandmother when she was 12 years old. She had her first child when she was 13, and she raised 12 children. Tell me now. I mean, that woman, that child bride, had to cook over a campfire, a little camp stove of some kind, bake every bit of bread they ever made, cook everything, grow everything they ate. How many people now know how to make a loaf of bread?
I just learned. I'm 34, so it took a while.
But think what they had to do. He died when she was still had six children to raise. And she moved her family to Uray and cooked for miners and took in their washing to raise the rest of her children. Now what happens?
Wow, that's an amazing story. There's a lot of people here who do go back, you know, five, six generations, homesteading families who've been here for a really long time. I had the chance to speak with Anthony Rober, who is Mark Rober's son, and their family has been here for at least five generations. I think it was six. Just hit the ground, as he put it. He was telling me, you know, that in the beginning, their family literally lived off of the land. Like, there wasn't one thing that they got that wasn't from this land, whether it was the materials they used to build houses, everything they ate, everything they wore. And it wasn't easy to homestead this land.
No, it wasn't.
Well, I was wondering, Julia, talking to some of these folks, have you talked to some people who have experienced such extreme change over the years that extremes in weather don't even really stand out to them?
Well, that's exactly what I've been finding, is that when I talk to people about the potential for change, the potential for drought, people go back to that history as a source of strength and confidence. Every year is a gamble. Every year is a different year. We will deal. No matter what nature is throwing at us, we are resilient. And this gives this history that the homesteaders, the people who came in from the Dust Bowl, that gives people an incredible confidence. And over time, you know, American history has demonstrated resilience. So I'm almost confident talking to them about these things, although the future is uncertain and things are changing, and it'll be up to us and up to all of us, newcomer or old-timer, to figure out how to move forward.
It's, you know, Dallas was talking about, was it 1937?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, 1912. It snowed 54 inches in 36 hours.
That's right.
So it sounds like maybe this last year was one of those years that they'll be talking about.
Absolutely. We just had the state climatologist Nolan Duskin here for an IC change event. And then we went out into the field and talked exactly about that. There is variation over time. You can go back to 1910, which was a very dry year. 1912 followed, you know, quite quickly after that and was record high precipitation. The difference is that now our background temperature is higher. And it's changing the game a lot. So we have this variation decades, every decade throws a big drought at us. Centuries will throw droughts at us, but our background temperature is higher. So those are the changes that scientists are really concerned about. Then again, you know, when you talk to people like Pat, or if you talk to people like Brian Farmer or the Hardings, there is a degree of confidence, and so somewhere in between there is probably where we're heading. Mm-hmm. We're going to be making changes to our lives. We may be bringing in new technology. A lot of the water conservation is going to be part of the discussion. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting times. But then again, you talk to these old timers, and it's been interesting times. So, you know, there's always change.
You were talking about how you felt like a lot of these people that you've been speaking to recently, the old timers, a lot of the farmers and ranchers, were environmentalists. They may not call themselves that, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I don't have a clip right handy, but there's some great ones. I would say that they do call themselves environmentalists, but the words are just a little bit different. They are stewards of the land. So When I think about a lot of the climate change dialogues that I've been having, you know, in the East Coast or before I even came here to do this project, we have been talking about people who are conservative or maybe don't believe in climate change in a way that isn't really jiving with what's happening on the ground, with real farmers and ranchers are incredible stewards of the land, are incredible environmentalists, and they're very much steeped in science. Every day, farms are living experiments in their own right, and ranches as well. And, you know, in terms of their skepticism or their approaches to land, those are very valid, very, very valid observations, concerns about the science, about the dialogue, about the debate. But they would say that they are the best stewards of the land, and because they live on it. They depend on the land. Everybody here depends on the land. Regardless of your politics, it's the thing that unites everybody here in this community, and that's what's so special. And again, the almanac that we're developing, and we're going to be talking about that in a little bit, is very much about that connection, about our connection to the land.
We'd love to hear from you out there. This is a live call-in show, 970-527-4868. Tell us your story over the years. Tell us about 2002. That was quite a year I hear people bring up sometimes. Yeah. Tell us what you're experiencing again, 970-527-4868.
Yeah, no, this area has survived many droughts before, and this is a very unusual situation. This is a very unusual year. It has broken weather records that have been set since 1895. And, you know, it was a tough summer. I mean, people really did ride this roller coaster of drought. I spoke with Stella Campbell. Actually, she brought me to church in Crawford, which was a wonderful day. And there were a lot of people there, and they've been praying a lot this year because of the weather.
And we actually did have many Sunday mornings where we figured God knew what he was doing, but we sure would like for him to maybe look down on us and see that Fruitland Mesa was out of water. The Ghoul was totally empty. People selling off their cattle, which was also hurting their income and also causing rifts in families where they weren't used to having to sell the cattle so early. It's usually the calves that they sell, you know. So yeah, it felt really weird. It's just like that dry, 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 day in and day out dry sun, and was choking the valley up here in Crawford. But yeah, I see change in the way the weather patterns. We're definitely in a dry, whether it's only 1 year drought or what, we are definitely in a dry, dry situation. I've never seen so many box elder bugs in my life. When it's real moist and rainy, you don't have them, but when it's dry, they really hatch. Where I live, I had two outbreaks early in the spring, and then in July, another just unbelievable hatch out of the eggs. So that was a big thing for me to see change, because I've never seen them. I've never seen that kind of double birth of the box elder bugs. The eggs were allowed to stay dry enough to hatch, you know, so
it was a really weird year for bugs. We've got lots of bug stories that we've been working on. The weird weather has definitely changed biology. I mean, this is a landmark year for biologists. And so scientists are really interested in hearing about these observations, about Stella's comment about box elder bugs. Biologists like Amy McKinney, for example, from the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, she studies the timing of flowering and pollination. We recently profiled her on a story about hummingbirds.
The first really obvious biological signal of climate change is the timing of events. To have data for 37 to 35 years on an interaction is really rare. So we team up as often as we can with citizens who have data on the timing of biological events. And so not just I saw a bee here and then I saw a flower here on this day, but I saw a bee visiting a flower on this day. That's the interaction that we'd like to see.
So again, Amy and scientists have been looking for people who keep records, who keep journals. It helps them understand how pollinators, birds, bees, are affected by climate change. She's even partnered with a citizen on a science paper. She's co-authored with citizens on papers using data that they have in their journals about hummingbird arrivals in Arizona, or the last appearance of snow on or the first appearance of bare ground every year. And, you know, if you take walks, you know, every day and you see things, that is a transect. It's a funny way of saying a routine, but you'll start to notice things. And you know, all this talk about journals got me thinking. I came to Paonia because of a program called Localore. I'm one of 10 producers across the nation. We're embedded with local stations, and our whole focus is to reinvent public media, to rethink public journalism. Now, this morning I was thinking, you know, the root of the word journalism comes from journal, which is actually Latin from the adjective diurnus. I think my Spanish is better. Diario is also very much part of that word. But the word diurnales means daily, daily journal. And locally, there's this tradition of keeping daily farm journals. It helps to know the inputs and outputs of a ranch or a farm. And it's also fun to know when frogs start calling or that lightning bugs were appearing around the 4th of July. So all this stuff, all this information pooled together on the community level and compared against real-time temperature, precipitation, or snow data could be really useful, particularly as weather and the seasons and the climate vary and change over time. So, you know, whether you have an old set of historic journals in the attic or if you just want to start making observations for the first time today, it all counts. It all counts right now. And we're hoping to launch the IC Change Almanac in November online. So if you're interested in participating, you can email me. My email address is icchange@kvnf.org. You can call me here at the station. That's 1-866-KVNF now. And of course, you can post right now on our Facebook page. We'll be using all of our Facebook posts for the almanac. And it's just a really exciting time. There's just been very active discussions and very active observations, lots of great photos. And Allie, you've been taking photos too, right?
That's right. For IC Change, I wanted to participate in a project where I would go out onto my deck every evening and take a picture of Lamborn. So I've been doing that now since pretty much Julia got here. And I have to say, it's an amazing experience. I feel like I know that mountain really well. It's become like a friend of mine, you know. And it's not so much that the day that you take it that has the impact. It's the fact that you can look back over an entire year and see how much change really is taking place and sort of have more of a relationship with that thing or that place. I mean, you can do it with a person too. You can take a picture of your kid every day and watch them grow over a period of time. You can take a picture of, I did it with my basil. I planted awesome. The seeds and I took a picture of it growing until I had a picture of pesto at the end. So these kinds of things are actually really fun to participate in, and you can really get some good information out of them at the end of the process and learn a little bit about yourself, learn about the environment you're in. And I think we actually have a caller on the line.
Excellent.
Brian from Hotchkiss, are you there?
Hey, Allie, it's Brian.
Hi.
Hey, so I heard you talking a minute ago, and I don't know if you played a clip or if that was someone in the studio, since I'm not there right now, about the box elder bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that prompted me to remember an event that happened here in Hotchkiss. I don't know, it was last year or the year before. Was that a person in the studio who was talking, or was that a clip?
That was a clip. That was Stella Campbell. So she lives in Crawford. And she was, this year she saw so many box elder bugs.
See, I thought it was last year here at our house.
Same with me.
We had a ton of box elder bugs, so many that at night, if you walked under the cottonwood trees, they would rain down on you. And my kids were young enough, I thought that was pretty cool. Now, what I had noticed, and I've lived here only 10 years, so I'm hardly an old-timer, but what I noticed was that earlier that summer, the hornets were absent. Mm-hmm. It was like we'd had a hatch and then a late freeze, and it killed off all the hornets. Mm. And I wondered at the time if it was that the hornets had been preying on the box elder bugs when they were in whatever stage they would be in, larval stage. And then that, since the hornets were gone, the box elder bugs had a chance to really thrive. And they consumed a lot of vegetation up here at our place, that's for sure.
Oh, wow. Well,
I don't know if anyone else knows that, or if they saw the same thing.
Well, I experienced the same thing as you did. We had more box elder bugs last year than ever before, like just raining down on us. This year, nothing, not one. I haven't seen one, but I've seen a lot of black widows.
Yeah, we too.
We are definitely on the... Well, they have been crawling and creeping all over the place. We are definitely on the black widow beat, if you will. We're going to be rolling that out, I think, towards Halloween, just in time for that.
Ooh, but, perfect.
There's a couple of things. We had, in the last call-in show we did with Michael Soule and Chris Floyd, you know, both incredibly experienced biologists, this is a very interesting two-year cycle right here, is that we had one record-breaking precipitation year in 2011 that was cold, and then followed by the extreme in the other direction. So the ecology of the community has been changed and been pulled in two different directions. So there's lots of chains of events that are kind of affecting, you know, massive growth of one population and then shortage of others. Declines of others. So everyone's trying to figure all this out. It may just be that there's a natural cycle for box elder bugs that, you know, they peak and, you know, in certain years and then decline in others, or maybe they move on to other locations. I mean, Crawford is just, you know, around the corner. But it is a really interesting time to try and look and see how the ecology has reacted to these two extreme events with very little time in between.
It seems extreme to me, since I've been here almost 5 years. In the first year that we were here, there were a lot of coyotes in our backyard. Next year, nothing, none at all. Deer, tons of deer. Now, no deer. Now, just bears and cougars running around. Like, every year it seems to change. And sometimes when you talk to an old timer, they're like, yeah, you know, sure, there's a bear in your yard. Who cares? It happens. It happens sometimes. That's why I think it's interesting to ask them these questions, because sometimes these things that seem so out of the ordinary or extreme, they can put things into perspective. We are living in the middle of the wilderness, after all.
Well, that's you can get from almost no place else.
The old timers do have great perspectives. And there's another story that we're working on. I was just out in the field with sheep herders, out in the, and they have had a really tough time with bears. And just all of the weather and kind of economics of this year in particular has really hit them very hard. So I'll be doing a story soon about how they've been affected. But there were definitely a lot of bears, because they just are short of food. So it was a big,
big year for bears. We can't stop talking about animals, but they're such a presence this year, I think, of a lot of different kinds of animals that we haven't seen in a while. Thanks for your call, Brian.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. And you're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. This is an IC Change special with IC Change producer Julia Kumari-Drapkin. I'm Allie Lightfoot, and we're hearing from some old-timers, some local old-timers today on the topic of change. Who's witnessed more change than the old-timers? We'd love to hear from you, too. But first, we have a couple of announcements.
KVNF receives support from listeners and from Infria Wizirk Conservation Center, a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting rivers, public lands, and quality of life in Delta County since 1977. the Conservation Center welcomes new members and may be contacted at 527-5307 and theconservationcenter.org.
This program on KVNF is supported by the Rotary Club of Paonia, geared to service in the local community. The Rotary Club provides college scholarships to area youth to help them reach their educational goals. More information available at 527-4585.
And welcome back to Local Motion. We're here with IC Change producer Julia Kumari-Drapkin, and we're hearing from some old-timers in the community on the topic of change.
Thanks, Allie. So I've come across two, possibly three sets of historic farm journals. Going back to Dallas and June Harding, they have kept journals on their ranch. Dallas's mother kept journals, and June also kept journals.
My mother was an unbiased person. I know she would only put down what was there. She could put more information on a postcard more than a lot of people could put on a newspaper.
Hers are diaries, and she talked about gardening and transportation up and down Minnesota Creek. Minor journals. Those are my journals. I got them out. And they go back to 1988.
Yours do.
Mine do. These journals have proven to be invaluable. We have looked back for things. What day did we do this and that?
Probably not of any value to anybody but our immediate family, because we use them for business records or, you know.
So they might not even be what would do you any good. This would be the earliest one. Would that do you any good?
Let's start with that one.
So I did start with that one. And
did it do you any good?
Let's just say I opened up to September, for example. And remember, we were just talking about Amy McKinney, who studies hummingbirds. One of the hardest things to study is the timing of when they leave. So we've been encouraging our IC Change contributors to pay attention to the last time they saw a hummingbird leave. It's just, you know, it's easier to remember things that you see for the first time. But the things that you last saw, it's a little harder. And I opened up to September 7th, and here is an entry. Dallas and John finished up at Neil's. Dallas isn't feeling well. He took the afternoon off. Then we went to Ed and Grace Allen's for supper, along with Todd, Lisa, and Joel. Had a nice time. Hummingbirds left. Highlighted. She actually highlighted that part. And, mm-hmm. You know, she hadn't heard that story about hummingbirds at all, but they're quite iconic here in the valley and really important. They are pollinators and they're a signal for a lot of the other timings that are going on. So that was pretty amazing. And, you know, there's lots of little details in here about hauling water or you know, the weather. She always writes nice and underlines, or hot in capital letters, mm-hmm. and underlines. But there's lots of, you know, lovely information that she's clearly keeping for herself and for her family. But it's a practice that is very, very useful for what the scientists are interested in. And you know, there's lots of these journalers, I think, in the community. I haven't been able to speak with all of them, but if you know anybody who does keep journals like this, or if you have those historic journals that maybe your mother or your grandmother kept, that is all really important information, and we're hoping to provide an online place where that information can live, where all those stories can be housed and held. Judy Livingston from the Paonia Historical Society, she kindly lent me some farm journals of Will Beasley, who was an orchardist, and his journals go all the way back to the 30s through the Dust Bowl era. So I've just been, you know, kind of keeping in real time, just opening up to September, because there's just so much interesting autumn, signs of autumn everywhere. There, we had our first, you know, storm with dusting on the West Elks yesterday, the first date of the first frost. And I just opened up. I was just curious about apples. And in 1934, on September 15th, he picked delicious apples for the first time. And, you know, all of our harvest came in quite early this year. So these kinds of notes, these kinds of journals are really, really important, for understanding, again, how those growing degree days are changing, how the frost states have been changing. And I can just keep, I try and open this up at least once a night. Mm-hmm. he puts notes in there like, it blew like all hell, you know,
yeah.
Just really interesting.
Nice descriptions, you know, of the weather.
Well, it doesn't have to be a perfect observation. It doesn't have to have, you know, how many centimeters fell in your rain gauge, or the, you know, it doesn't have to be a perfect observation. Mm-hmm. All observations count for the IC Change Almanac. Together, we can all kind of get a better picture over time of what's changing. So, yeah.
When is the? Tell us a little bit more about the almanac.
Well, we had our first coming out party, if you will, just September 13th. Like, what was that, a week ago?
Mm-hmm.
Nolan Duskin, the state climatologist, came and did a presentation, and then we Skyped in with my designer, with our digital partner, Lindsay Wagner from Ziga. She came in really late in Boston time to be there for the meeting, and we showed the wireframes of the almanac. It is very much a document where you can see, like, where you can upload your stories, your observations, or ask questions. We want people to participate as much or as little as they would like. So we're planning to email everybody once a week, what have you seen change this week? And and the almanac, it's hard to describe something visual on the radio, but imagine a calendar that's set not in boxes, but over time, the way it kind of unfolds over time in kind of like the landscape of a season.
Mm-hmm.
So in the middle, you have all these pictures and videos. And then on the top, we're going to be putting real-time precipitation, temperature, and snow data from various sources. And together, you could maybe call that top layer a quantitative data. And then all of our stories are these quilts of experience. You know, maybe we could call that, a scientist would call it qualitative data. I would call it stories.
Mm-hmm.
And someone looked at the wireframes and said, well, it's not Facebook, it's Farm Book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we really do feel like that if we have a record of 2012, that it will be useful for generations looking forward and for people who want to look back and compare. Right now, people tell me about the drought of 2002 or the drought of 1977 or 1956, 57, or even, you know, these Dust Bowl journals that we have right here. But really, there's nothing that we can look back to and look at everybody's experience all together, except for those individual composition notebooks or calendars with notes in the margins scribbled on top of, you know, the usual Gregorian calendar. It's really, we've never done this before. It's the first of its kind, and we're really excited about it. And everyone who takes a look or who is interested in this is very excited, and their excitement makes me excited. So, you know, we're all just kind of jonesing on that.
And this idea really did come out of this community. It wasn't like you came here and knew exactly what you were going to do. What made you think of this?
It, again, came from listening to people. That was the first and most important thing. I came here, I had no experience in Paeonia. I didn't even know where Paeonia was when they asked me to come here. I looked on the map and I looked at my fiance and I was like, absolutely not. So I came here with open eyes and open ears, and that this is an incredibly engaged community. I've learned so much from just listening to people, listening to their change observations, listening to how they're making decisions based on the weather, based on phenology, based on the timing of events. And as that stuff's changing, it's changing us. Again, we were talking about the bears, you know, that uh-huh. keeps coming up. But the bears have had a serious impact on ranchers. People have been losing animals and thousands of dollars. We'll be doing a story about that in the coming weeks, but it is impressive. Just things that you wouldn't think of really, really do make a difference. And if we all had one place to talk about it and document it over time, it really would help. I think it would really help. It would help us in the community. It would help the community talk to each other about, you know, how to solve problems, but also it brings the scientists into the conversation as well. And that's been really fun, flipping the script, allowing the scientists to hear your questions and observations has been a really eye-opening process.
Well, I think it's really valuable for the scientists because they don't have as much of an opportunity to talk to people about what they're studying, you know, and actually speak to people in a way that they can understand it and not in these sort of scientific terms. So I think it's mutually beneficial for sure.
That's what's been so fascinating, is hearing that the scientists are paying attention and interested in the same things that citizens are. Actually, we can play that next clip of Jeff Schwartz and David Inouye. So that was our first IC Change story. Jeff had questions about frost times, and David was one of the first scientists I spoke to when I was still living in D.C. David works at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, and he studies the timing of spring and flowering and pollinators, and he's just always been curious about the fruit growers down here. So I actually, we're in phase two of IC Change, and we're going to be trying to bring the conversation from Facebook, from online, from the radio to face-to-face. And this was our first go at bringing a scientist into the community to speak with citizens.
My assumption this year, based on our harvest of fruit and vegetables, mm-hmm. From cherries through apricots, peaches, nectarines, plums, pears, and apples, mm-hmm. not only has every fruit been a bumper crop, and excellent quality fruit, mm-hmm. but every variety within that fruit that we grow mm-hmm. has been on. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, made me just feel like maybe it's a 1 in 20 year that I've heard mm-hmm. people say, but maybe it's a 1 in 100 years. Mm-hmm. Do you have any take on that, historical data?
The one thing I did to try and look at the history of fruit production in Colorado is that the state used to, and I don't know if they still do, I guess there's a Department of Agriculture that published an annual summary, and it was a book like a third of an inch thick each year with lots and lots of tables about what was the harvest of different fruits or production of different of livestock or whatever in the state of Colorado. And I did try and at some point to go back through those to see if I could pick out years. My particular interest was years where there wasn't much fruit produced because of late frost damage. And so I was trying to see how frequently did those events occur, so I could get some context for how frequently it occurs now. And it's interesting that you say that the fruits and vegetables have been super down here, because this was just about the worst year for wildflowers up where I work at 9,500 feet since I started working there in 1973. I think we had one other year, the summer of 77 was also poor, because the winter of 76-77 there was so little snow, and then there was so little snow this year. And what happens in years like that is the growing season starts early. The growing season starts early, and but the date of the last hard frost hasn't changed up at that altitude. So it's somewhere around the 10th of June, let's say, it'll get down cold enough to cause a hard frost. And in a year like this, where the snow melted in middle of April and flowering started in the middle of April, we had a hard frost at the end of April. We had another hard frost at the end of May, cut down to 10 degrees. Another hard frost about the 8th or 9th of June. And there was just very little flowering up at high altitude. So it's interesting that there was that much difference between what we saw with the wildflowers up there and what you're seeing down here a few thousand, 3,000 feet lower.
Well, yeah, maybe... the water had something to do with that too, do you think?
Well, it may be that things got an early start down here, but didn't have the same kind of frost damage that we had higher up.
So what did you find is the percentage of success for fruit crops in Colorado? Did you find that?
Oh, I did that work long enough ago. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I remember stopping at I think one of the other orchards in town, and maybe the maybe it was actually yours too, about 10 years ago before you were there, I think, and asking people who worked there, do you remember how often you used to have lose the apricot crop or lose the cherry crop? And they said, oh yeah, I remember back in this year and that year and that year. And I don't think they had written records, but people still could remember years that were poor years. And then that's why I wanted to see if I could find something in the written record.
And written records are particularly important in weird years like this. It's just so key to understanding how everything works together. And I love speaking with David Inouye because in many ways, he's like the old timer of scientists. He's been working at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab for about 40 years. And in that clip, he was talking to Jeff Schwartz from Delicious Orchards about harvests. And Jeff was curious to know, you know, if this is a 1-in-100-year event. And in many ways, it could be. We also know that most of the harvests came in early this year, anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks, maybe even pushing 4 weeks early. Again, those written records are pretty key for that. One thing that really did change this year is the number of growing degree days. And that's the number of base days where the temperature for growth of plants was, where the base temperature for growth of plants and animals was reached. And I'm looking into that for yet another story. Again, I just wish there's just so many great stories. One thing that I came across in the literature was that growing degree days in the West compared to growing degree days in the East is significantly different. In the East, the rate of change is 3 days. So that's not that much. Mm-mm. In the West, the rate of change is 20 days since 1900. So when you ask a farmer about their crops and they say, well, every year is different, really, every
yeah, they're not kidding.
Year is different. And so, again, we're all trying to figure this out. It's one big puzzle. And it's not just crops that are affected by growing degree days. It's bugs. And we've been getting so many bug stories. I can't even tell you. And, of course, those mosquitoes that we've reported on earlier this month, it's really made a big difference in terms of health and the West and in terms of West Nile virus. So I spoke to Georgia Hopper after the Hotchkiss Town Council meeting, and I wanted to know what she thought about climate change. She's been a big proponent of spraying, and, you know, with climate change, there will be more mosquitoes, hypothetically. So,
are you curious about it?
Not really.
Even if it meant more mosquitoes?
If you can prove that to me, then yes. But I'm sorry, it's something I don't really believe in. I don't really believe in climate change.
Can I ask you, this is my whole project.
Okay.
So please don't believe it. I'm just like, why don't you believe it? Just curiosity.
I can't see that much change. Now, I really should go back because maybe I have evidence somewhere that I'm not even thinking about. My father kept a journal for 40 years and always had the temperature, the weather, everything. And Mother saved all of those books.
Can I see those? Can I see those?
I would have to ask my mother.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know.
That's my entire project.
Is it?
No, really, because basically we're trying to see if we can see it here in the community. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm with you 100%. Like, can we see it in the journals? I don't know. And the scientists are really eager to find those because they need to know, too.
Well, my dad kept them probably for 60 years. He's been dead now for 15, 20 years. But I know Mother has all of those books. In fact, because of his diary, someone who had been hurt in the mine, and he didn't make a report. Well, later on, he had serious problems, and he went to my dad, and he says, did you by any chance know when I got hurt? Daddy had it right there in his diary, and the guy got his compensation, whatever it was, because of that.
Would you be willing, could we look at the journals? I mean, would you ask your mom? Or
I will ask my mother. Now, my mother's getting senile, but I will ask her.
So, you see, it never hurts to ask.
No, wow, you got really excited when,
I did.
When she told you about those journals.
So far, I've only found 3 sets, and that includes the one of Will Beasley that Judy Livingston lent me. It includes the Hardings and and Dallas's mother. So I'm looking for as many sources as possible, and we're hoping to provide a space in the Digital Farmer's Almanac where we can say, well, 30 years ago, delicious apples were ready for harvesting. So all of this information helps so much, and I have learned so much talking to old-timers, and we're going to continue with this conversation. I'm here through the rest of the year doing all four seasons, and whether it's a newcomer or an old-timer, trying to help us all understand what's happening. So, and again, after all these talks, I have to say I do have a theory about who is and who is not an old-timer.
Oh.
I so far have been able to define an old-timer as anybody who says back in the old days within less than 5 minutes of meeting them. So I literally hopped out of the car and, you know, met June Harding on Minnesota Creek Road, which is, by the way, a crazy road for for someone in their 80s to be driving on. And literally a minute or so after I got out of the car, she told me this story. The back in the old days story. Thanks, Jeff.
Back in those days, they had fair dances. And they had a dance two or three nights in a row during the fair. And I went with some of my girlfriends. I lived on Rogers Mesa with my folks. And he was there with some of his friends. So we met. We both loved to dance. We met. He took me home from the dance. And he was quite a Romeo. And he wore the outfit of the times, Levi's, rolled up 6 inches, and white starched shirt. He was quite handsome. And so we danced all night long, and he asked if he could take me home from the dance, and I said, well, I guess so. I was playing hard to get. So he took me home, walked me to the door, and reached out to hug me or something, and I said, oh, I'd never let a guy kiss me on the first date. So he looked at me, and he said, I'll kiss you hello then. So he grabbed me and gave me a kiss. That was the beginning. And he's very romantic. He's still very romantic after 60 years. It'll be 61. In fact, it was 61 this past July. I think it's going to last.
I think so. It's a pretty good bet. Yeah. I bet. I'd say so.
I think.
How old were you guys when you met?
How long we lived here?
No, how long? How old were you when you met?
20. I was 20. He was 23. I was grown up enough. I'd been around some. But I didn't know this was in my future.
This being the ranch, and hopefully the IC Change Almanac can provide a place to document all these incredible stories, all these community stories, all these ranch stories, all these farming stories, all these family stories. So there's this one last clip that we're going to play that that she told me, and I've been thinking about this a lot because her enthusiasm again feeds into mine.
You know, what is so fascinating to me is you new people, really new people who've moved in here, are so curious about our old ways.
It's important.
That's nice. That's really nice. And you want to find out what your new place used to be like. Huh. Well, I appreciate that. I never thought, though, that anybody would ever be interested in anything like this. But that's nice. More power to you. I hope it works.
More power to you, Julia. That's just great. I love that.
I hope it works too. And it only will work if everybody participates. And you can participate right now in so many ways. You can email me, icchange@kvnf. You can call me here at the station. Of course, you can post right now to our Facebook page. We'll be using all of those posts for the almanac. And face-to-face works just as well as Facebook. I'm easy to find. I walk around with a microphone that has what looks like a dead cat on it. I'll be handing out flyers all weekend at Harvest Festival. And I would love to speak with you. Thanks for having me, Allie.
Thank you for being here, Julia. And that does it for Local Motion today. You're listening to us on KVNF 90.9 in Paonia, KVMT 89.1 in Montrose, and on the web at kvnf.org. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.